Greetings. I am Shisada Akona Kamada, and welcome to Satsang with the Shambhala Center. You are beginningless. You are endless. You are divine. Good evening. Welcome to Satsang. I'm Shisada Kona Kamada, and I'm also joined by PLEN. Thank you for being with us tonight. I'm going to do something just a touch different. Tonight we're going to do our protection as usual, and I'm going to have us just sit for a few seconds afterwards. So when I finish the protection, just keep your eyes closed and stay nice and centered, and stay with us. Take a deep breath. Call yourself forward. Mother, Father, God, that I am, through the Great Central Sun Hierarchy, through the Office of the Christ, through the Order of Melchizedek, I call upon Archangel Michael to bring the sapphire blue ray. Cut away, cut away, cut away anything in all of our four lower vehicles not emanating directly from our I Am presence. I now call on Archangel Zachiel, Keeper of the Violet Flame. Blaze, blaze, blaze the violet flame through all of our four lower bodies. Transmute, transmute, transmute all the psychic debris Michael has cut free. I now bring forth the invincible ring, pass not, and the mirror blue light of invisibility to completely surround each of us. And I call forth a shaft of pure Christ light to surround each of us. And I ask that these shafts of light be brought to the center of the earth, where I call on Archangel Gabriel to seal them. And I ask that the legions of Michael completely surround each tube of light. And now I ask that our vibrations be raised high above the psychic and astral worlds to the highest realm of illumined truth we each can attain at this time. Now, Mother, Father, God, we place ourselves in service to you and to humanity. PLAN and I place ourselves in service to all of you tonight. We ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted into our perceptions, and that all else of the lower mind be kept out. And we ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted through us. And because we have asked this, we consider it so. So be it. Very good. I'm glad you all come back to me. That was nice, huh? Yeah?
That was really good. I had a flashback to our intensives.
Did you? That was a singing bowl, for those of you who don't know that sound. It's that one is actually very heart chakra. It's beautiful. It clears space beautifully. And the energies today have been quite discordant. I think that's putting it mildly, but we'll use that word. And so clearing space is always a good thing. Okay, where are we picking up from last week, PLAN?
We did have some people that wanted you to elaborate on the cup is already broken.
Ah, okay. It's such a valuable little statement. And I'll start you off with a quote from me.
Aha!
Every now and again, something brilliant comes out of these vocal cords. So here's this. And this is directly related to the cup is already broken. The only thing permanent here is impermanence. And of course, that shows us the paradox of what we're dealing with here. Do you have that weird look on your face for any particular reason? Or
I'm multitasking. I'm tweeting at the same time, and I'm thinking, how do I spell impermanence?
That's funny. Okay. So the only thing permanent here is impermanence. And that's a kind of another way of saying the cup is already broken. Anything that can be experienced here in this third density reality is not real. It is not permanent. All right. So the permanence of what you are, right, is what you know it to be, what I've said over and over and over again, beginningless, endless, formless, single, being, knowledge, bliss. There's Satchitananda. That's the permanence of what you are. Anything outside of that is not permanent. It's transient, okay? So as we know this reality being a reality of duality, anything that comes into this reality must then leave this reality. So here we have the life-death cycle, perfect example of how nothing is permanent. Okay, anything that comes into existence here will have an end point. You know, even the solar system itself will have an end point. Our sun will have an end point. This planet will have an end point. Your consciousness as it exists within the construct of kind of carrying this body around will have an end point. So one of the greatest teachings from my perspective of the Buddha was that the cup is already broken. And if you can take that on as kind of your daily mantra, it keeps you from experiencing the suffering that comes along when we're attached to the desire to keep the cup from breaking. See? So if we can accept right from the beginning that whatever it is that you are experiencing, whatever pleasure it gives you, whether it is a cup, whether it's your teapot, as PLN just experienced this week, whether it's a relationship, someone that you love dearly, all of these things will have an ending point. And I was speaking this to a student this week in particular, saying that, you know, it wouldn't matter even if you got your dream mate. I promise you, there's an expiration date on there because one of you is going to leave before the other, right? Most likely. So what we can gain out of the teaching of the cup is already broken is that the only thing that matters is that we just stay present in our love for what is. And in this moment, the cup isn't broken. And in this moment, I can treasure the cup. Or in this moment, the person that I love is with me, either with me in physicality or with me in my heart. But in this moment, that person is with me and I treasure that, right? If we have the person in our life that we say we love, but yet the majority of the time that they are actually with us, we're thinking about something else. We're worrying about what they might do, or we're projecting out, you know, how we might lose them, what it would be like without them. You're already there in that future space and you're calling it toward you, but you're not present with the person. So to be present means that the story of the past and the story of the future falls away and there is no story, right? And then in the moment when we witness the breaking of the cup, the moment after it's witnessed, it's done. And there's nothing to regret, right? And nothing to even look forward to after it. It's just done. Just done. And it is the holding on and the attachment, right? It's the concept that whatever the cup represents is something that is meeting a need of yours. And the only way that you feel you can get it met is by having this external thing fill it. And for most people, that is a person, right? And I think we said last week, like that from the movie there, you know, you complete me, right? Jerry Maguire, right? You complete me. That's like a perfect representation of how unhealthy people really are, because you are complete and there is nothing in the external world that needs to come into your space to complete you. You are complete. And when you experience yourself as the totality, the wholeness, the holiness of what you are, then anyone or anything that comes into your space is treasured from a very pure place and a very innocent place, not from a place of manipulation or domination, right? Wanting to control another and make sure, oh gosh, you're like, I have to make sure I act a certain way or they might leave, right? Because now that I have it, I have to hang on to it, right? All of this stuff leads to suffering. I mean, you're suffering while you're in it. And then what happens to most people is that they do lose it, and then they regret the loss of it. And then they'll look back and say, gosh, why wasn't I with them more when I was with them? Yeah, that's a hard way to learn a lesson. But that's exactly what happens. So through lots of self-inquiry and the work that we do, we can move into the space where we are capable of just functioning purely from our hearts moment to moment. It's this one beautiful ongoing moment. Yeah. And that really is, that kind of encapsulates the cup is already broken. Do you feel that covers it? I don't know if anyone would have another question about it.
No, I think that's good. Yeah, I think that's perfect.
Okay, good. So yeah, it's good. What else?
Do you want to go to our question that Brittany was asking? The difference between ego and mind?
Oh yeah, I love this question that I run away from all the time. Oh wait, no, that was last week's question. The difference between ego and mind. So the question basically was, are they the same thing? Because in the work, we use the word mind, but people are used to hearing the word ego.
Yeah, you have a lot of people use ego.
Yeah. So I'm not going to get into the real nitty gritty of it, because I really don't think it's necessary, because it's really only humoring your mind to sit and kind of delineate between one and another. But I will say that the lower mind, as we refer to it here in this work, consists of the ego, but also of other things. So remember, in the moment of perceived separation, what came into being simultaneously was the ego, right? The lower mind itself is the ego. It was physicality, the life-death cycle, right? And all of those formed at the same moment. So the lower mind consists of more than just the ego. The ego is the sense of me, the sense of I am, right? But within the four lower bodies, there are multiple levels going on there. And it's not terribly necessary that we really get into that. That's not really my level of expertise. I could talk about it, but it's not necessary to the work we're doing. But just know that people, I think the big problem is, you know, coming off of like the work of Freud and everything, like we have a concept of what the ego is, right? With Freud, it was like the id. You have the id, the ego. And it's most people associate it with the self-inflated sense of self. So for someone to have a big ego would mean that person thinks too highly of themselves, right? And that's kind of, so when we hear people out in the world generally, because now they're starting to get their hands on the concept of that duality consists of the ego, and that, you know, the dissolution of the ego is the work that needs to be done. So a lot of people, when they, how do I say this? They move into a space where they aren't witnessing themselves functioning from a bloated sense of self. They now say, I don't have an ego. And it's like, well, don't be ridiculous. Of course you do. You're still in form here, right? Literally, I think it was Sai Baba, and I hope I get the quote right. I believe he said that if you were functioning completely outside of the personal self for, I think he said 29 days consistently, you literally couldn't hold form here anymore. Because remember, we live in the world of opposites, right? So you can't hold form. There always has to be a little piece kind of left sticking there. And remember again that the point here is not to make any kind of a change. It's just to see through the whole story itself, you know, the story of polarization. And once it's seen through, then you can actually navigate your way through it, but you aren't of it, right? And that is the being in the world, but not of the world. And I'm going to go, because you just stuck that Krishnamurti quote on the Shambhala Center Facebook page, and it's perfect for this. What he said was, if you begin to understand what you are without trying to change it, then what you are undergoes a transformation. It's such a beautiful teaching, and people can't understand it to hear it just in such a simple form. What he's saying is that here, like I just said, in this world of opposites, when you understand that you are, and let's pick something that most people would perceive as negative, right? So let's say you are cruel, and you finally see that you're cruel, because most people, of course, would be in denial. They'd repress that, and they'd be in denial of it. At some point, you actually will see it. Well, the automatic reaction is to then repolarize with it. So now it's, oh my gosh, I've seen that I'm cruel. That's bad. So I need to become kind, and I need to work really hard to be kind. Okay, well, then you're just repressing it more. And so what Krishnamurti is saying there is that when you actually see it without any need to change it and allow the cruelty to be the cruelty, right, without a story behind what it is to be cruel, that it's not necessarily a negative, it just is, then at that point, as he says, what you are undergoes a transformation. So at that point, if it's not of the eternalness of you, right, then it automatically falls away. And so you find the kindness just coming forward very naturally and the cruelty falling away very naturally because there's nothing holding it. So remember that, you know, if you're saying I'm not that, in your saying I'm not that, you're actually working to hold on to it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure you understand that. If you're saying I'm not anything, I don't care what it is, I'm not whatever, you're actually holding on to it. And you're affirming that you are it by saying that you're not it. It's two sides of the same coin. You're saying I'm one side, I'm not the other side. All that means in this reality is that there's one side that you are conscious of and that you're working very hard to identify with. And the other side you are equally identifying with, but you refuse to acknowledge it and own it. So the identification is happening in the unconscious rather than in the conscious mind. But they're both held equally. And then, of course, where do you see it crop up? Well, you're going to see it in your outside world, because anything that you can't own as you has to come forward to be in balance. Remember, everything is about balance here. So you're holding one side, and then the other side is going to come forward in your outside world to balance it out. And then you'll see the cruelty everywhere outside of you. Okay.
Or even in you, like if, you know, say if something happens and you're triggered, mm-hmm. you'll just revert right back to it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and then you can see it in yourself and move into this that state again. You know, reactive mind takes over, you're cruel, you witness it, and then you push it away again. Oh, I can't believe I did that, right? And then we're just repolarizing with it rather than really looking at it and seeing what's sitting underneath it. You know, there's a reason that that came forward. There's a reason that you don't want to identify with it. There's a story behind it. And you learned it. You know, you learned it. Most likely, if you find yourself being cruel, it's because as a child, most likely, as a child, you had someone who was like a primary caregiver who was cruel. And as the child being on the receiving end of cruelty, the child will consciously hate it, right? Because it feels terrible to have a parent who's cruel to you. However, remember, I've told you before how mind works. Mind will always program itself to take in kind of everything that happens, and it will always take on the winning position. So if there was an altercation and a parent is cruel to the child, obviously the parent is going to come out looking like he's the winner, or she, to the child, who is the, you know, the victim of the perpetrator parent. And now, even though the child says that I will never be like my father, like my mother, because I would never want to do that to my child, it hurt too much. Why would I want to do that to my child? You know, if you love your kids, why would you want to do that? That's all a very innocent, very pure place to sit. But the mind patterns after the winning position. So it takes on the position of the parent who is cruel. And then what happens is that at some point for that child after he's grown, when the child gets, now adult, gets triggered by his own child, he will automatically react from what won, you know, and how he patterned after the winning position as a child. And now he'll be cruel. He won't be able to stop himself because reactive mind takes over. When reactive mind takes over, there's no capacity to function from your own will. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. So at that point, you'll just watch it, and it's like, boom. And usually in the beginning, when it first happens, it'll really shock a person because they can't believe they just did that, you know, if they're aware enough. And they may feel terrible about it after. And that's good, but at the same time, it's still holding that, you know, that behavior is bad. So it's still holding in form. Right. But that's exactly how that works.
Yeah.
Clear?
Clear.
Okay. Let me say something tonight. I've been watching the energies and just watching people. And mostly it's in my own household because I'm not out in the world a whole lot. So I get a lot of what's moving in the collective I see in my children. They're so kind of pure in their response to the way the energies move through. They just attach to them all over the place. And so I get to watch the collective through them, which is kind of lovely. What I was seeing recently, and it's certainly nothing new to me, but I was really watching tonight in particular, was how everybody just wants to escape. And this is something that, you know, I looked at very specifically concerning people on their spiritual paths a long time ago, because it became so obvious to me that most people come to their spiritual work initially from that place of, you know, I just want to get out of here. Especially when the whole concept of ascension came, that was, you know, the big kahuna, like, whoa, so what, just tell me what to do because I just want to get out of here. Or you have those who, you know, are counting on the light beings, you know, to come and beam them up and take them away when things get really bad, which isn't going to happen most likely. So it's interesting when you watch patterned consciousness in the form of your children or your coworkers or your spouse, anyone in your world, that this, everyone's in this space where, like, it seems most people are in a space where when something is coming into their reality that they don't like and that they don't want to do, it's like this whole push it away, you know, cry about it, feel bad about it, play the victim with it, push it away. And people just are not willing. they may be capable, but they're not willing to just stop and stop their sob story long enough to be willing to look objectively at themselves. Because the reality is that whatever it is you're experiencing in your world, even if it doesn't seem to be directly related to you, let's say it's something you're seeing on the news, okay? It doesn't matter. Whatever you're experiencing in your world is part of your karma drama. So these are all condensed energies that you've carried with you through lifetimes, and they're all coming forward at this time to be balanced out. So if you're sitting in a space of, oh, poor me, this always happens to me, and, you know, it shouldn't be like this, and, you know, he's such a jerk, and why does he always do that, or whatever, if you're playing that game, you're missing an amazing opportunity to actually evolve out of the need for any of that. It's your karma. I don't care what it is. People get really touchy about this because especially if you bring it to them that, you know, your cancer is your karma, people do not want to hear that. They want to blame it on the outside world. No, it's because I smoked. Well, you can say that in this world where it seems like cause and effect is a, you know, is at play. The bottom line is it wouldn't come forward if the karma wasn't there to support it. See what I'm saying? Because you see guys, you know, 90 some odd years old who, there was one man I remember, he was like in West Virginia or something, and he was 98 and they were interviewing him, and, you know, his rituals, he smoked all his life and he ate, you know, 2 eggs and 4 pieces of bacon like every morning for like 60 years, you know, and he was fit as a fiddle. Why? You know, you could have another person eating the same diet and they'd come down with cancer. Okay. So he's clear, right? It doesn't need to manifest that way for him. But other people, it does. And it's there to show you something. But you've got to get out of your own victimization to start to be willing to look at it. So I was looking very closely today at a little girl who knew going into the school year that she was not doing well in math. And she was encouraged to continue practicing learning her multiplication tables because that was the thing slowing her down the most. She wouldn't have time to finish her homework or finish her classwork because she was still counting on her fingers rather than just knowing them by rote. So she had opportunities to practice with siblings and parents and all of that. And she certainly was reminded by her teacher over and over again how important it was that she learn. And here in North Carolina, we have these end of grade tests, and it was made clear to her that if she didn't pass the end of grade test, that she'd have to repeat the year. It's kind of a big deal, right? So that's fine. So she got notice that today that she'd have to start going 1 day a week after school for math tutoring. And she was all upset. And so when I spoke with her, I was like, so, you know, what is it that you're so upset about? And of course, it's this whole story. I don't like math. I blah, 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 right? Just all poor me. I feel so terrible. And everyone should feel sorry for me. And I shouldn't have to learn math. And I shouldn't have to do this. Again, we go back to that. Everyone wants to escape that thing that they don't want to do. And I looked at her and I said, you know, who do you have to blame for this? Of course, it's always someone else's fault, right? And I just looked at her and I'm like, you know, you had the opportunity. It's not that you weren't given an opportunity. It's not that you weren't told very directly what the consequences of your choices was going to be, right? You chose to push that aside. You chose to do other things, even when you knew that the right thing to do, that right action would be to practice the multiplication tables. And now, since you've pushed it away over and over and over again, it's come to your doorstep and you can't push it away this time. Now, this is brilliant because this is exactly how things work here in physicality. And I tell this to my students. I only tell them once, usually, because it's one of those understandings that, as a guide, you have to allow people to fall on their faces when they're just supposed to fall on their faces. So sometimes, even though we hate to see it, we just have to keep our mouths shut. But I always tell someone at one point, look, you're being given an opportunity to see things. And it is up to you. You have the responsibility, once you have these understandings, to go in and unroot, you know, the unmet needs that are sitting underneath it, that of course lead to the desires and then to the attachment and then to the judgment, the justifiers and all of that stuff. So your opportunity is there, and you don't have to go looking for it because it's going to find you. But what I always tell people is, if you're willing to go in and look objectively at the personality that you are, that you think yourself to be, if you can look objectively, then there's no stopping you from going in and rooting out everything without having to go through the life experience of it. You can do that. But understand this, if you're given an understanding, if something comes up and you see something about yourself, and then you don't do the work, and it'll come back, you'll see it again, and you don't do the work, you know, you're usually given a couple opportunities or a few. But at some point, if you refuse and you keep pushing it away and repressing it and not wanting to look at it, at some point, the physical universe is going to make sure that you get the point. And you will have to live it out in the physical. That can be very painful, because it can manifest in any number of unpleasant ways, right? But you're forced to see it, because it was time. It was time the first time, right? But you do have free will. And no one can step on your free will. So if your free will decided, as with this young lady, you know, her free will said, I'd rather sit on my Kindle than practice my multiplication tables. You can only do it for so long, even though she had that nagging voice inside saying, I really should be doing that. I really should be doing that, right? But she ignored it. And then what happens? Well, it's brought to her doorstep, and now she's got to deal with it. So I'll ask all of you tonight to really start paying attention at where you're pushing things away that you don't want to look at. You know, where do you see things about yourself that you're in resistance to? If you're in resistance to it, it means that there's something there that needs to be looked at. It never fails. Every single time I'm sitting with someone and I'll make a comment to them. You know, you blah, blah, blah. And they'll go, oh, no, I don't. Bingo. As soon as you feel the least little bit of resistance, you know you've hit it. That's it. So find that in yourselves. You have an opportunity to really look. I feel resistance to this. If someone tells me I am this, I tense up. Right? There's your cue. The tension is your cue. Remember last week we talked about subtle physical cues, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Little shock to the solar plexus is always a good one. Feeling your shoulders tense up, getting a headache, all that stuff. So pay attention. It's really important. You have what we're looking at now is the way that the energies are moving, and the way that the vibrational levels of light that are coming in and keep coming in and keep coming in, they're not going to back off. They're going to every time we have a new moon, every time we have a full moon, every time we have an equinox or a solstice, these influxes of light are going to be more and more intense. So we are looking at the dissolution of an entire reality. Okay. So it's going to continue to ramp up. If you're resistant now, you're really going to be hurting a year from now. See what I'm saying? I mean, if it's hard now, I can't even imagine what it'll feel like a year from now. You have to be willing at this point to really start looking at what you're holding on to, or what you are attempting to not hold on to. Same thing, right? And then within that, it's really super important to have a sense of humor about the whole thing. You know, your spiritual work is hysterical. You know, it's like the number one lesson we teach right from the beginning is like, don't take anything personally. Because, of course, there is no personal you. There's only one lower mind, and it's acting out all the personalities, right? There's only one. And it's experiencing itself as all of us. But there's only one mind having one personality playing itself out here. So don't take things personally. No, there's nothing out there that's personal to you at all. Nothing, 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 nothing. And I don't care what it is. Remember, we go back to the story of the silent sage, you know, and the guy who's just about to stab him in the chest. I mean, he didn't even take that personally. He said, "Thou too art God." That's all he could manage to get out before the guy killed him. It was completely impersonal. He's like, "Yeah, I get it. I know. I understand why you're doing it." Right? And having a sense of humor is like really, really important, because and it's very understandable when you are subjective about what you're looking at and you're attached to your stories, it will be painful. But when you're objective and it's not your story that you're looking at, it's quite funny, most of the things we see about ourselves. I mean, because we're ridiculous, you know, we're consistently ridiculous in the way we function. And sometimes it's heartbreaking. You know, I was saying to PLAN before our program tonight that, you know, it can be really heartbreaking when you see how cruel people are to each other, because it's just the patterning that's talking. And they are people that they do truly love, but they'll just be nasty just because their own patterns have been triggered. And so the reactive mind takes over, and remember, winning position. And then they function from that place, and then they'll be cruel. And when you stand in an objective place and you witness that, it is heartbreaking to watch, because the thing that's heartbreaking isn't, and this is where you'll hear me, but you won't really get it until you've experienced it. The heartbreak is not in the action that's taking place. It's not the fact that, you know, a dad just yelled at his kid, and you could see the child just shrivel up as soon as he did it. That's not the part that breaks your heart. The part that breaks your heart is the fact that here you have two people who love each other and they can't even see what they're doing. And they can't stay in touch with their heart enough to stop themselves when that reactive mind wants to jump in. Because you do get to a point where that gets stopped. You know, you do have divine will, and it will come in and stop. You know, it'll witness that in that moment, this is what the personal self wants to do. And that divine mind comes in and it says, "No, that is not me. I will not do that." You know, and then it becomes a very natural thing, and that kind of falls away. It doesn't even have to happen anymore. But having a sense of humor is really important. I'll share just a little story because I love it. I love it when we get, I get beautiful little messages from the masters. I was, my mom lives up in New York State, and I'm down here in North Carolina. And I don't like going up there in the winter anymore because of the snow. I always hit snow when I drive up. And when I'm traveling with the kids, it's not worth risking their safety. So I always bring the kids up in the summertime to have some time with their Mimi. And she has blessed me with taking my girls for a couple weeks in the summertime, which is, you know, for a full-time mom, is such a treat. And so I think it was just this past summer, I was driving home after I had dropped the girls off. And it is by myself, it's about a 14-hour drive. And I drive straight through, right? So it's a long day in the car. And I had... you all know by now, like I adore Commander Lady Athena. I just adore her. She's here on BBS, and her show Voice of the Ashtar Command is on Wednesday nights. And I had a whole huge list on my iPod of her archives, you know. And so I was excited because I had an opportunity alone in the car to, you know, get my Athena fix, right? So... So I had left New York, you know, it had probably been, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning, and I was in Virginia. I remember very specifically it was Virginia because I was in the Shenandoah Valley. And I remember getting this god-awful headache, just this horrible headache. And I was like, "Oh, like how strange, you know, what is that all about?" And I saw in my inner sight, it was hysterical, Saint Germain came in And anybody who knows Saint Germain and who has had personal experiences with Saint Germain will tell you he's hysterical. He's like the comedian of the Ascended Masters, right? And Saint Germain came in, and because my question kind of was like, "Wow, like what is going on that my head is hurting all of a sudden?" You know, and Saint Germain came in. He goes, "Lighten up, would you?" And I was like, "What?" And it dawned on me, I had been listening to Athena, high vibrational, you know, heavy duty work for like 10 hours straight. Right. And I was so in this space of like, gotta get it. You know, like the seeker who just can't get enough kind of thing. Many of you know what I'm talking about. The Saint Germain came and he's like, would you lighten up? You know, like you are way too serious. And it was like, oh my gosh, point taken. You know, like I saw it so clearly in that moment that it just wasn't necessary. You know, it just wasn't necessary. And not that that doesn't negate anything about her teachings or her work, but for me to listen 10 hours straight, feeling like I had to cram it all in, you know, it was overkill, right? And so that's the masters are always kind of, you know, you're here to kind of live your life and experience the world, you know, and find the humor in it and enjoy it. Right. That's funny, isn't it? She is. She's
you literally fried your brain.
I did. I fried my brain.
Because all I could think is how I feel after 3 hours of satsang. Like I'm like literally like butter brain. So.
Yeah. Yeah. My nervous system was like, ah. Oh, that's great. So it was a good reminder at that point of just lighten up. I mean, you know, you take, and again, everyone takes everything so seriously. You take yourselves so seriously, and it's just not necessary, you know. Enjoy the world. Enjoy the next breath you take. Enjoy your cup of coffee in the morning. Enjoy your cigarette, like whatever it is, enjoy it. Like I always say to people, because people get all, you know, hung up on, well, how do I do this? And how do I do that? And I'd like to do this, but I can't afford that. And it's like, oh my gosh, like, how could you ever be happy in the middle of any of that? You know, if you want to go to the movies, awesome. Go to the movies and have the full experience. Like get popcorn and get candy and soda and like whatever it is and love every second of the movie. Right. And then of course, so you just spent $30 at the movies, right? Okay. So now, you know, maybe I can't go again for a couple months, but if you're going to go, do it. Live it. Be in joy with it, right? Don't go and not get the juju bees because then you're like, I can't afford them. And then you're sitting watching the movie. You're like, oh, I wish I had my juju bees, you know? And then you're not even present with the movie. You're sitting in the juju bee place. It's not necessary. It's just not necessary. Y'all make it so hard and it's so simple. Life can be so simple and everyone makes it really hard. So let's focus, you know, this is kind of a bringing it more to a psychological place, and that's fine because there's a place for that. But, you know, focus in your world right now on just being kind. You know, can you be kind when the world is unkind? Because, you know, you never know what's going on with another person. You don't know why they're acting the way they're acting. And I know I'm not telling anybody anything new here. But start paying attention. You know, don't use someone else's behavior as your excuse for being a jerk when it's just not necessary. Someone cuts you off in traffic, so then what? Then you feel like you have to speed up and then cut them off and flip them off as you're driving by them. You know, what is that actually proving? Right? What does that prove? It doesn't prove anything other than you're very reactive and you've got real issues. How do you know there's something going on with that person? And, you know, but yet you expect better behavior from others if you have to cut them off. Right. And that's what always happens. You'll hate the person who cuts you off, but then you'll do the same thing to someone else and then you'll excuse yourself for it. Yeah. So let's be kind. There's no reason not to kill them with kindness, right? Is there anything else this evening that you wanted to have me touch on?
No, we actually hit everything. We are going to play a song. Is there anything that you want to say about that song?
Nope. Okay. Other than it is a meditation. And I do have something else to share with you before we get to the song. But before I do that, why don't I just take a minute and plug what we need to plug? The biggest plug that I have right now is there is a movement underway, which I think is very exciting. So I want to share it. It's called Add Your Energy Gatherings. And the concept behind the Add Your Energy Gatherings is to get together globally with anybody who's, you know, based in their heart, to sit in either prayer or meditation, one 2-hour block a month, collectively. And scientifically, we know everything is energy, and certainly that has a spiritual basis to it as well. That's very ancient. I mean, in the Vedanta, I mean, they knew everything was energy. That's nothing new there. But science is actually proving it now. So the beautiful thing is, I think it's through HeartMath, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's through HeartMath that I think I remember Greg Braden saying at one point that if like roughly 145,000 people on the planet were to awaken fully, that literally in that instant, consciousness on the planet would shift out of polarization and into non-polarization, you know, to unity consciousness. That's not that many people. Based on, you know, however many billion there are, you know, 145,000 is not that many people. So the concept behind Add Your Energy is that while it's awesome to have, like, you know, every now and again, like these big global meditations, it's fantastic. The concept behind Add Your Energy was let's do it every month and let's just continue to make them bigger and bigger and bigger. Right. And then there are people who are part of the Add Your Energy movement who are facilitating these meditations. So their energy is going out. They're being used as vessels for energy coming in from, think of it as like multidimensional energy, coming in and moving through them to all of those who participate. And it's a very exciting thing. So I did want to share that tonight. That is at, you can find that on Facebook, AYE Gatherings. And if you go there and like that page, then it would give you an update automatically when the next meditation is going to be. And I think at some point they'll have a website and all. I think they'll also make the meditation music available for download for each one too. So if you wanted to meditate along to the same music and get the energetics that are coming in from that, that'll be there for you too. That's the big thing I wanted to mention. And then, of course, we have our Shambhala Center, the ShambhalaCenter.org website, which we'd love to have you come join. And on Facebook, the Shambhala Center. I think that's about it there. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to share with you before we get to our music. And again, our music is meant as a meditation. It's there to kind of, a lot of stuff comes up when we sit in these sessions. So you'll have a lot of, you can look at it as if, like consciousness is kind of, you're throwing off layers of consciousness when we have these sessions. So we can use these meditations as a means to kind of clear our energetic space coming out of satsang. It's something that I would do if I hold a physical satsang. Like I always clear the space before I leave it. So we can do these meditations each week as we leave the program and kind of invite that violet flame in to kind of blaze through us and transmute any of that discordant energy that has come off of us during the work. So that's kind of the focus of these meditations. So going into this, I have a little poem that I wrote almost a year ago, I guess it was. I had some time alone and I'm a big writer and words always come to me when I'm alone. And I thought this was particularly pretty when it came in. And I actually just happened to pull it up right before we started tonight and I saw it and I was like, oh, let's share that tonight. So sit with the words and when I finish, Don, if you're listening to me, when I finish this little stanza here, I'll have you go right into the music. So I'm going to say my good night now and thank you so much, all of you, for coming and listening with us again. And here we go. Within me and you, there is love. Between me and you, there is love. Connecting me to you, there is love. And when the grand illusion of me and you falls away, what remains is love.
You are divine.